Black studies, from history to psychology, sociology, Black feminist theory, the arts, meaning visual arts, also performing arts, music, Black theology, African American education.
Hey everyone, Nathan Long here, president of Saybrook University in beautiful, 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 beautiful Pasadena, California. Welcome to another episode of Saybrook Insights. I am really over the moon for today's guest. This incredible human was a member of my doctoral committee back in the day and was a vital mentor to me during graduate school. And the reason we're having him on the podcast is not just for some vanity project on my part to show off my fabulous committee, but he's done some amazing work throughout his entire career, including his most recent book, Introduction to Black Studies, which you can find on Amazon and other book retailers. I'd highly recommend you buy it. It's really quite good, and he'll go into some depth about what that book's about. Dr. Eric Jackson is a professor of history and director of the Black World Studies program at Northern Kentucky University. With almost 28 years of academic experience at the university level, he's taught numerous classes in a variety of fields, such as Introduction to Black Studies, History of Race Relations in the Americas, Historical Themes in African American History, History of the New South, and the War of Independence and the United States Constitution. Additionally, he's published a wide array of book reviews and articles in many local, regional, national, and international journals, such as the Journal of African American History, the Journal of Negro Education, Ohio History, the International Journal of World Peace, and the Journal of Pan-African Studies. I was remarking to Dr. Jackson, it's like a scroll of stuff, of articles and books that he's done. It's incredible. Currently, he serves on the editorial board and is a book review editor of the Journal of Pan-African Studies, as well as the editorial board of the Northern Kentucky Heritage Magazine. This guy really just doesn't stop and is an inspiration to me and really so many students and colleagues. Today, we're going to explore again his new book, which I had the privilege to review, along with his thoughts on history, Black history, and the current state of affairs in America. And I think you're going to love a lot of what Dr. Jackson says. We even toyed around with the idea of maybe calling him the Hope Peddler, his words. All right, let's get to it with Dr. Eric Jackson. I am so pleased to have on Saybrook Insights my dear friend and colleague, but and also one of my former doctoral dissertation members. He was instrumental in my own background, my career as a researcher, scholar, and my current day as a president of a college. Dr. Eric Jackson is just has had a profound influence on my life, but also on the lives of countless others I know through his teaching and his research. Dr. Eric Jackson, great to have you here today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, Dr. Jackson, tell our audience about your background before you entered the world of academia. How did your passion evolve for history and all things history?
I'm originally from Gary, Indiana, which is maybe 20, 25 minutes from downtown Chicago. So I don't remember a time when I didn't love history. I think the first time my brush with history was when I was a kid, and I saw, or at least remember, I remember the assassination of Dr. King and Malcolm X, and then I saw all these people like emotionally crying. And so I was trying to figure out, I was a kid, what was that all about? And so from that point on, I started digging into their history. Like, who was the Reverend Dr. King? Who was Malcolm X? Our city was going through this phase in the civil rights movement where Richard Hatcher, one of the first black mayors in the United States, was mayor. And I remember also as a kid meeting or being at an event where Amiru Baraka was there and trying to understand this kind of nationalistic movement in the civil rights movement. And so from that point on, my views on discovery was opened. Who were these people? What were they talking about? Why were people clapping when they were saying, talking? What was going on? So from that point on, it was kind of a calling that I knew I was either going to be a college professor or go into law. And so from that point on, maybe 5 to 7 years old, I that was just my calling. And it still is my calling.
5 to 7 years old. Oh, my gosh. That's impressive.
Yes. So, yeah, I mean, so that's my background. I grew up in Gary, Indiana, went to Gary Roosevelt, which is one of the top schools at the time. So sports school. I played in band. I was the nerdy kid. I mean, I took all the upper echelon classes in history and anthropology. At the time, it wasn't even called anthropology. It was called cultural history. And I was in a band and did all that stuff.
So then you migrated into college. Where did you end up going to undergrad after high school?
Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana. My alma mater as an undergrad. So I went there because I had family there, but I also, one of my first college trips was there. I went to visit Purdue in West Lafayette in the middle of nowhere. Not that Muncie is a big city, but it was close enough to Indianapolis that I could get there in 45 minutes. It's 45 minutes north of Indianapolis. And then IU was kind of in the middle of nowhere too. So
Got it.
Those are my stories.
Yeah, it is. It really is. You went on to do your master's and then a doctorate, and I believe your master's at University of Cincinnati, or was that at Ball State as well?
University of Cincinnati, my master's in history. Yes, at the University of Cincinnati and my doctorate there.
Okay, got it.
And that's where we went.
Got it. Yeah, that's right. I knew where you got your doctorate from. So yeah, absolutely. And it's so you went on, you were teaching at Northern Kentucky University, and you still are for that matter. Tell us about that experience of coming into academia as an historian, as an African-American scholar, as an African-American man. What has that journey and passage been like for you?
Oh, I'm not really. It's some ways it's the same as every other graduate student. You go into academia with these grandiose ideas that I'm going to be this great scholar. And then you get in there and like, oh, my God, I've got all these books to read. I've got to figure out how to read them in a certain amount of time. And nobody tells me the key. Nobody says you're just reading for evidence and thesis and arguments. You're not reading page for page, word for word. So you get overwhelmed, you get all stressed out. And I guess it's a little different for persons of color because there's not a lot of folks who look like you in higher education. When I was a grad student at the University of Cincinnati in the history department as a master's student, I think there was a 13-year gap between myself and the person before me in that program. And so knowing that, you just kind of navigate it in a different way. But I had been used to that anyway. I mean, being a regular kind of quiet academic person from 5 to 7 years old and reading a lot of history stuff, you kind of create your own world and understand that you're doing something that's different than everybody else. So you just get comfortable being different, not just because of your race, it's just because of the path you have been destined to take.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I appreciate that insight there. And as you've kind of moved through your career, you have this wide array of historical publications. I was going through your list and I'm like, I just didn't realize like it's a scroll. You just like, everything you've done, it's amazing. And it ranges from the heady academic literature to public scholarship to media news articles. It's very impressive. And your particular focus on African Americana and Black studies. Talk a bit about your inspiration here. You alluded to this, of course, in your, you know, sort of the foundational stuff that you were talking about with Dr. King and Malcolm X. Why does this history continue to be vital from your perspective as an academician, as a human?
I guess for me, it's important because it reflects my personal journey and my personal connection and understanding the plight of that discipline of African-American history, which is different than African-American studies. African-American history is a field within African-American studies, but it can be one and the same depending on who's teaching it. I guess for me, it's just, I feel that I'm called to do, I guess, and what I'm comfortable doing. So it's the material, the topic, the research, the venue has to speak to me. I mean, I'll sit around and think about it and pray about it, and then it just kind of flows. More times the topic chooses me. I don't really choose a topic.
Interesting.
Particularly nowadays. Nowadays when I can write whatever I want to write and not be caught up in the whole, I've got to do this to go become a tenured faculty member or associate or a full. And now it's like, okay, I do what I'm comfortable doing and what speaks to me. For example, the introduction of Black Studies book was a seven or eight year journey, because when I first started teaching out of grad school at Northern Kentucky University, there was no specific textbook that was aimed at the general public or first or second year students. Most of the material read like graduate texts. Not to say that it's bad, but when you're teaching first and second year students or first generation students or people from different backgrounds, the language was not accessible to those groups of folks.
Agreed.
As compared to a grad student. And so I'm like, okay, if I can't find anything because I was piecemealing things together, I'll write my own. And it just took me a while to get to it.
Well, that's such a great, I want to dig into your Black Studies book here in just a moment, but that is intriguing how you said, you know, like it's part of the academic life, right? Where you're vying for stability through tenure or through, you know, in our case at Saybrook, you know, longer contracts. So we don't have tenure here, but, and then once you get there, you can rest and now I can write what I really want to write. Right. And really home in on that. If you could go back and rewind, what would you have maybe not done differently, but what would you have maybe added? I don't want you to feel like you have to be controversial here, but what might you have written 20 years ago when you were in the tenure, what do you call it? The hamster wheel of tenure and all that stuff.
I don't think I would have changed anything. I mean, I just cranked out. I mean, at that time I was just searching for my calling to become have more clarity. I mean, it was just more clarity of understanding the non-dominant society's plight for assessing their empowerment that spoke to those folks who didn't normally have voices. I mean, it's not to say, for example, and I have this discussion numerous times, not to say that the so-called founding fathers were bad people. But there's so many books about the Jeffersons and the Washingtons and the Lincolns and the Madisons. But there's not a whole lot of books on Septima Clark or Angela Davis. There's a few, and I'm choosing those for a reason, or a Margaret Garner. So those type of folks. And I'm specifically mentioning Black women in particular for a reason. Not to say that the focus should not be necessarily on African-American males or other folks from different non-dominant populations. It's just specifically there's not a lot of scholarships or non-scholarship materials on African-American women to this day. I mean, I talk about it in my class. I ask my students, aside from Coretta Scott King, maybe Betty Shavazz, maybe Rosa Parks, who else do you know, Black women who are involved in the civil rights movement? And 9 times out of 10, they can't name one other person. And this is last year.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I choose those topics to give voices to folks to who normally they don't have a voice.
Well, I think it was you who said to me when we were, I you probably recall it. We're now 23 years out from that. But the book we wrote on the 20th century African American peace leaders, that's a whole other story for a different podcast in terms of the placement of that book. It was what was illuminating what you had said to me, because we were talking about the integration of Josephine Baker and Diane Nash Bevel and Angela Davis and others. And you said to me, these women have very rarely been covered in even in this way. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. My like, surely they had to have been covered. And as I, you know, my work study thing at the library that I had going on at the time, I go in and I chunk in the old Vax machine search engine. And I'm like, my God, not only it's like the glaring, almost it felt like omission. It was a glaring omission of these women and so many other women's voices, Black women's voices, from the narrative of history. I think it was true then. And unfortunately, I think to your point, I think it's still true today. I think we need to do a much better job in the coverage of that space. Is that still fair, or would you say it's getting better?
Oh, I think it's the three steps forward, two steps back perspective. I think we've making certain strides with certain people, but you still have thousands and thousands of other women of color who people don't know about. I mean, particularly if you expand the horizon out of just women of color, meaning African Americans, if you talk about Latino women or Asian women or other non-dominant society women, that vacuum, that area still is not where it needs to be compared to other groups, which is mind-boggling. This is 2023 and we're still having this discussion, but hey.
Our Saybrook scholar, and for our larger national community, Dr. Jackson has just laid down the challenge, the gauntlet. Get out there and start doing research and bring scholarship and write on Black women, Black women's voices, history-wise, and other. So, yes, amen to that, Dr. Jackson. So, appreciate it.
Yeah. I mean, I was just having that conversation with a buddy of mine a few hours ago, talking about just understanding this nation when it comes to our definition of freedom. It's even the founding fathers themselves, which is ironic, didn't know how to define freedom if it wasn't for how they defined and held enslavement at its baseline, because they were owning people and they said, we don't want to be like them. We've got to figure out a system where we're not like them.
Freedom is for the wealthy landowning white guy, you know, and we got to keep that, you know, in place. And we don't want to be like, So I want to dive into this because your commentary it's a great segue. You recently published through University of Kentucky Press, I believe, right, is the name of, and I had the privilege of reviewing an advanced copy for you, along with a slew of other, you have way more distinguished folks looking at it than me. So this, your book on Intro to Black Studies, can you discuss the nature of the book? And you talked a little bit about its genesis, but maybe talk some more about that and what new insights you gained in authoring that publication.
So the book is its title, Introduction to Black Studies. It's a more first, second year general public volume that lays out the eight major disciplines of Black studies, from history to psychology, sociology, Black feminist theory, the arts, meaning visual arts, also performing arts, music, Black theology, African-American education. I don't even know how many I'm counting here, but the thrust of the matter is it tries to get at the experience of African-Americans from different disciplines. Based on the history of Black studies as a academic discipline, starting in the early to mid 1960s, at places like University of San Francisco and Kent State, Michigan State, Yale in the 70s, And what I try to do is to show that traditional disciplines consciously or subconsciously left out people of color in their makeup, in their history. And so Black Studies was a way to not just understand those disciplines from an academic standpoint, but to show that you take those disciplines in the communities to try to solve everyday problems. For example, if you look at sociology as a field, a lot of times that early sociologists, what sometimes was being used to justify racial segregation. But what Black sociology is trying to do was trying to uncouple that segregation and empower people in the community and talk about things such as the Black family, crime, healthcare, disparities. How do you resolve and try to come up with solutions to those problems in the community? And so what I tried to do that in that volume is to lay it out more strategically and more non-academically intentionally.
And why was that focus so important to you, that non-academic focus, critical from your point of view?
Because I think academia in some ways has become unintentionally, I don't want to say elitist, but I want to say a great number of folks in general may not have access to academia. And so how do they have access to the discussions that could change their communities if they're not in academia? And so I wrote that book in a way to, if somebody would just pick it up who has nothing to do with the academy, would say, ha, this is an idea I can take into the community to understand more intentionally how we can use art as a way to improve the concept of social justice, or how sociology can be used to deal with the prison industrial complex, as they call it in academia, and in non-academic terms is how we can deal with the disproportionate of Black folks going into the criminal justice system. And what do you do about it? So that's for me, is to kind of uncouple the academic language and make it plain, as the song used to say from James Brown.
It's beautifully written. And I think you called attention to so many important things. I was, one of the things that I am excited about, I think, as we source this around our university and other connected entities, our sole focus is in psychology, but it was our founding discipline. And, many of our current day faculty have really focused on the importance of Black voices in psychology, not just in the academic realm, but in the therapeutic room, in the creation of greater understanding of Black wellness, Black well-being, mental well-being and health, and how to address those major issues. And I think your book really, I know it's not like a huge psychological focus, but what you're saying resonates so importantly, I think, in this and many other spaces. So just sort of reiterating that in a different way from the psychological point of view.
I think you're right, and I did that intentionally, because just the lack of folks of color who go into psychology and even counseling. I mean, from a cultural standpoint, not to say a person who's not a person of color can't be a counselor for a person of color, but it does help. In some instances, actually, maybe in a lot of instances, if that person of color is a counselor, can understand the plight, the psychological dimension of being a person of color in the United States, that sometimes it's mentally and emotionally feels attacked on a regular basis. And you don't have to have that discussion from a counselor. They can just say, yeah, I know what you're saying, because they've may feel the same way. The mental health was a thing, as I call people. I tell people mental health was a thing for people of color before it was called mental health because they were feeling like they're being attacked from the larger society. And how do you deal with those emotions? How do you deal with the spiritual attack on who you are as a person? It's mind-boggling. And so psychology is a field that was created in certain ways as a Western canon and didn't take in consideration other cultures, particularly African culture or African-American culture.
Really well put. Really well put. Well, we're coming to the, I feel this like flew by. I mean, we could go on for another. I really could go on and on with you about all of this. And we will in a different venue. I do want to hit this question. And I think even if we go over a little bit, it's so timely and it ties back to your work in Black Studies. We were just, we actually had a recent board meeting and invited a number of students and alumni. One gentleman comes from Florida. He is a Black man. He's gay. And, as he said, it's kind of, I'm paraphrasing here badly, but basically he's in the midst of a massive threat storm. Right. So he's in the eye of the storm and he's targeted from all sides. And many in his community in Florida are targeted. It feels like anyway, and goes back to the mental health piece. We're extremely polarized. Clearly, it's not just Florida, it's elsewhere, and it's almost like we're experiencing both an accounting over the last few years of racial injustice and trauma. And a visceral backlash, which is the anti-racist efforts. From your point of view as an historian and kind of providing some analogs historically, because you do this so well, what are those analogs that may exist to contextualize the current milieu that we're in right now, from your point of view?
So I'm going to just do historical themes, and then I'll see if I can kind of wrap it up in a couple of examples. So if we just talk about language, particularly when we talk about visceral, violent language, that's not new necessarily. I mean, history kind of rolls around in cycles, but with new players. It's like a checkered board playing checkers, but the pieces have changed. Because the same language you can find in antebellum times when they were talking about African Americans and using minstrel shows and all these other derogatory world fairs and all this other stuff that came during the turn of the century after the Civil War. So the language of violence, the lynching episodes, the police brutality, that kind of stuff, it's not new. If there's one common theme about American history, it's violence towards the other. So that's not new. What's new about it has to do with the social media where people can hide behind no names, the kind of new immigrant migration patterns in the United States that's come from different countries over the years. Our response to it is, it's pretty much the same, ranging from denials to anti-racism mentality. The hope is we can learn from the past, me as a historian in my job, and other folks who claim to be historians and want to be historians, is to understand that what we're going through now is not new. So learning from the past and the positive attributes of how we've dealt with it over the years, try to use some of those mechanisms to alleviate the legacy of hate speech or violence or the other being attacked by the majority. Just understand that we have done this before. We can learn from the past. We know how to build coalitions. It's not going to be easy. It's never has been easy. And from a historical standpoint, the United States is basically, 250 or so years old, roughly? So we're a relative new nation.
we don't have that history of the continent of Africa or Asia or other continents that we're working through our growing pains. That's not something somebody wants to hear that's going through this plight, but understand that plight may be for those people who are going to come after you to make sure the system is better. So it may not just be a temporary thing that you're looking at it as your own struggle. How do you make the system and the country better for that next generation? I mean, because at the end of the day, it's easy to continue to waddle in division, separation, and camps of tribalism. It's hard to stick out to be a hope peddler. You peddle hope. You give people hope in the future. I mean, that's my favorite phrase now is I'm a hope peddler. I have to figure out how to give people hope in the midst of all this stuff. I'm not peddling anything but hope. Not drugs, not booze, which is whatever. I'm peddling hope. I got to pour into you the best way I can, hope. Because if you don't, the other way is gloom and doom. And it's so easy to do gloom and doom.
Dr. Jackson, the hope peddler. I think there's a... I love it.
That's my next book. My next book? No, I'm joking. That's not my name.
I really think it might have to be. Yeah, no, that's great. What a great way to position that. And I think you're absolutely spot on. My wife and I talk about this quite a bit, right? In terms of the arc of history in the U.S. is short, but the arc of human history, of course, is long. And we've seen this real play over and over again across civilizations and across timelines. And you're like, yeah, this ain't new. It just isn't. But unfortunately, to your point, how do we use history in such a meaningful way to create that, as you had said it so well, peddle hope to advance hope, because there is hope for the future, but it's hard work. And I think you hit the nail on the head too, with the idea that I think we talk a lot here at Saybrook about the exhaustion that our BIPOC populations are feeling and how to hold on to that hope. So what kind of parting thoughts would you have before we get into our final two questions? What for folks who are in the struggle, what anchors do you have for them? Where is the hope from your point of view?
My hope is in, which gets us back to the Black Studies book, particularly the history chapters and the music chapters and the religion chapter, is that despite the hardships, people of African descent, African Americans, figured out a way to survive and persevere. They just did. If they did it through creating songs, if they did it through creating their own institutions, if one of the objectives of the enslavement period was to destroy a people, it didn't work because they're still around. They found ways to persevere and continue in the struggle. So that's what I would ask people to do, to understand history even better. Underground Railroad data and narratives are important when you have what y'all call the first human rights movement in the history of the United States, of people of color and progressive folks working together for change. And they're not the well-known people. I mean, some of those folks do, but they're not in it for the money. They're not in it for their names. Or as I tell people when I talk about that subject matter, ordinary people can do extraordinary things all the time if they choose to do it. It may cost them, but ordinary people can do extraordinary things all the time if they choose to do it. It could be as simple as finding somebody who doesn't look like you, talk like you, walk like you, listen to the same music, doesn't eat the same food, and just say, let's break bread and have a conversation, because that's not the narrative in 2023. It's just not.
Yeah.
And it's so easy. It's easy, and it's a slow walk, but it works.
And it's hope-filled. It can be.
Yeah.
It can be.
It's peddling hope, man. Peddling hope. The hope peddler.
Well, Dr. Jackson, I could talk to you all day long. It's a real pleasure to get time on the screen with you. You're just awesome. We have two final questions that we ask of all of our guests, and you are not excluded from this because I think you're going to have some great words of wisdom. These are what we call quick takes. So the first things that come to mind, as I tease guests, you're not being graded, especially by the humanistic psychologists on our faculty. So don't worry about that. But we start off with the first question for everyone is, what does the term humanistic mean to you?
Wow. Humanistic means to me is that there's a baseline that we as human beings can connect with. And so we look at ourselves in a way that we can connect as basic human beings in a positive way. So that's what I define it as basic connecting points that crosses race and ethnicity.
Fabulous. And the last question, and we're gonna tweak this just a little bit, given all the hope peddling you've been doing today. With all that's out there regarding the challenges we just sort of talked about, what are the three actions or steps people can do right now to improve or help make the world a better place?
Oh, that's easy. I echo the same points I just made before. Find somebody who doesn't look like you, talk like you, listen to the same music, eats the same food, find that person and have a conversation with them. Find some connecting points. It's easy. It's so easy. And we just, sometimes we get too busy in our world of busyness, however you want to define that, in academic or non-academic activity, that we just kind of ignore the humanistic aspect of people, that you would just walk by people and don't even acknowledge their presence, which is a way to continue to divide folks. I mean, you don't even have to have a big conversation. Just say good morning. I mean, we're at the stage sometimes. I make my students, I sit outside my classroom and in my classroom every day I teach, and actually make my students say good morning as I say good morning to them. And it's so fascinating. It's like, I'm not a morning person, Dr. Jackson. I'm like, that's not the point. The point is to acknowledge people as human beings in their presence, not just walk by them like they don't exist.
Yeah. It's a real person right there in front of you. That's right.
So, yeah. Yeah. That's my way of answering your. I don't have three steps. I just have one.
There you go. Words of great wisdom from the famous Dr. Eric Jackson.
Or infamous.
Famous me. Or infamous. That's right. Eric, where can people find you on the web? Where's the best way to get their mitts on the book and also find you?
They can email me at jacksoner@nku.edu, jacksoner@nku.edu. You can find my book on Amazon. You can find my book on University of Kentucky Press. I have a website. I just don't know the... Just email me and I'll send you my website and you'll find all my links.
In fact, we will put the website in the show notes so that that folks can access your stuff. Eric, Dr. Eric Jackson, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here today. It's been an honor, really, and a privilege to have you here.
Thank you so much.
All right. That was incredible. I hope you enjoyed Dr. Jackson as much as I did. Go get the book, first and foremost, Introduction to Black Studies. Remember Dr. Jackson's major takeaway. He defied convention and went with one, and I love it. Find somebody who doesn't look like you, talk like you, isn't in your sphere. Find that person and have a conversation with them. Break bread with them. Sit down and have conversation. That's going to be key to breaking down polarization. I think he couldn't be more correct. So take those wise words and everything else Dr. Jackson said, and let's put them to use. If you want to see the YouTube version, please visit our Saybrook YouTube page. If you'd like to support the podcast, go to Apple iTunes and leave a 5-star rating and review and subscribe so you can get episodes as they come out. If you're on Spotify, leave that 5-star rating and make sure to follow us. You can, of course, subscribe to us on most major podcast platforms. And just a reminder, Google Podcasts is going away in just a couple of months. So if you're using that as your podcast catcher or your podcatcher, YouTube Music or music on YouTube now has a podcast platform in it. So that's going to be your go-to. Of course, you have other platforms, including Stitcher, Pandora, Amazon, and others. Remember to check our show notes for Dr. Jackson's information, including links to his book, website, and other areas. For more about Saybrook University, go to www.saybrook.edu. Click on Areas of Study at the top of the page and locate the program of your choice to learn more. I also will pitch here Northern Kentucky University, where Dr. Jackson is on faculty and in the leadership teams. Go there at www.nku.edu. And if you're looking for Saybrook online, Google Saybrook University and you'll learn all about us. That's it for today, folks. Take care, be well, and have hope. Thank you.